Citizen Soldiers, Disc 6.
Part 2. At the German Border. The glorious victories of July, August, and September came to an end in October. In November and December 1944, the U.S. Army was unable to advance farther, and in mid-December it was thrown back. The ensuing Battle of the Bulge was, like Gettysburg for the Civil War, the most famous battle of the war. Also like Gettysburg, it was a victory for the U.S. Army, but only a defensive victory. And wars are not won by fighting on the defensive. Chapter 6. Metz and the Hürtgen Forest. November 1st through December 15th, 1944. Northwest Europe in November and December was a miserable place. A mixture of sleet, snow, rain, cold, fog, short days and long nights cried out for winter camp, for shelter and indoor occupations. Rivers were at flood stage. The already poor roads were churned into quagmires by military vehicles. Veterans speak of the mud as knee-deep and insist that it is true. In the center of the American line, in the Ardennes, portions of First Army did go into something like winter camp. It was a lightly held, quiet area, where divisions just coming into the line could be placed to give them some frontline experience. Eisenhower and Bradley figured the terrain made it the least likely area the Germans might counterattack. All was quiet there. But north and south of the Ardennes, First and Third Armies were on the offensive. The weather be damned. There was no strategy involved. The rain and mud made rapid movement impossible, and there was insufficient gasoline to supply deep thrusts into the enemy rear. Once the generals made the decision to continue the offensive, the war in the fall of 1944 became once again what it had been in the hedgerows of Normandy, a junior officer and NCO battle of attrition. A steady flow of replacements coming from England allowed the generals to build companies up to full strength after a few days on the line, even when casualties had run as high as 90%. Eisenhower was prepared for this. In early November, he sent out a teletype to all headquarters. Combat units are authorized to base daily replacement requisitions on anticipated losses 48 hours in advance to expedite delivery of replacements. To avoid building up overstrength, estimates should be made with care. Signed, Eisenhower. The replacement flow added to the sense of strength. Surely the Germans couldn't keep up. At higher headquarters, the feeling was, just one more push here, or another there, and we'll be through the Siegfried Line and up to and across the Rhine. In addition to individual replacements, new divisions were coming into the line in a steady stream. These high-number divisions were made up of the high school classes of 1942, 1943, and 1944. The training these young men had gone through at Fort Benning and other stateside posts was rigorous physically, but severely short on the tactical and leadership challenges the junior officers would have to meet. Paul Fussell was a 20-year-old lieutenant in command of a rifle platoon in the 103rd Division. He found the 6 months training period in the States to be repetitious and unrealistic. He was struck by the futility and waste of training and retraining and finding some work to do for the expendables awaiting their moment to be expended. In the field, our stock in trade was the elementary fire and flank maneuver hammered into us over and over at Benning. It was very simple. With half your platoon, you establish a firing line to keep your enemy's heads down while you lead the other half around to the enemy's flank for a sudden surprise assault, preferably with bayonets and shouting. Fire and movement had been the doctrine developed by General Marshall when he was at Benning in the 1920s. Marshall had reasoned that in the next war, the Army would expand rapidly and therefore needed to develop a technique and method so simple and so brief that the citizen officer of good common sense can readily grasp the idea. "We all did grasp the idea," Fussell remembered. "But in combat it had one signal defect, namely the difficulty, usually the impossibility, of knowing where your enemy's flank is. If you get up and go looking for it, you'll be killed." Nevertheless, Fussell saw the positive benefit of doing fire and movement over and over. Perhaps its function was rather to raise our morale and confidence than to work as defined. It did have the effect of persuading us that such an attack could be led successfully and that we were the people who could do it. That was good for our self-respect and our courage, and perhaps that was the point. This was distressingly close to the Duke of Wellington's sole requirement for his lieutenants, that they be brave. Fussell was a rich kid from Southern California who had a couple of years of college and some professional journalism behind him. He had blown the lid off the IQ test. Had he been born 2 years earlier and brought into the Army in 1941 or 1942, he would have gone into the Army Air Force or intelligence or onto somebody's staff or sent back to college for more education. But he was one of those American males born in 1924 or 1925 to whom fell the duty, as rifle platoon leaders, to bear the brunt of the Battle of Northwest Europe after their older brothers and friends, born in 1922 or 1923, had driven the enemy back to his border. There were hundreds of young officers like Fussell, lieutenants who came into Europe in the fall of 1944 to take up the fighting. Rich kids, bright kids, the quarterback on the championship high school football team, the president of his class, the chess champion, the lead in the class play, the solo in the spring concert, the wizard in the chemistry class. America was throwing her finest young men at the Germans. Among the fresh divisions was the 84th Infantry. It had gone through its training cycle in mid-1944, then sailed for Europe. It came into France at Omaha Beach on November 2nd and moved by truck to the front. Bradley assigned it to the new U.S. 9th Army, General William Simpson was the CO, which had taken over a narrow part of the front, with U.S. 1st Army on its right and the 21st Army Group on its left. The 84th's left flank tied in with the British right. K Company, 333rd Regiment, was on the extreme left, outside Geilenkirchen, some 20 kilometers north of Aachen. K Company was an American mass production item, one of its officers remarked, fresh off the assembly line. It certainly was representative. There were men who could neither read nor write, along with privates from Yale and Harvard, class of 1946, and sergeants with college degrees. They came from all sections of the country, and every major ethnic group, save African-American and Japanese-American. One of the sergeants, Franklin Brewer, was different in many ways from the other NCOs, especially age. He was 37 years old, so the men referred to him as Father Brewer, or sometimes as Mother Brewer. He came from a Philadelphia mainline family and had a Harvard degree. He was fluent in French and German. He had traveled extensively in Europe before the war, moving in the highest literary circles. He referred to his friend Gertrude Stein as Miss Stein. She made him a central character in her book, Bruzy and Willie. And here he was, a sergeant in a rifle company on the front line, because he wanted it that way. So K Company may have been mass-produced, but it had a right to think of itself as unique, with its own personality and character. It was special, too, because Captain Harold Linebaugh, a platoon leader and then CO, and Lieutenant John Campbell, a platoon leader, wrote the company's autobiography, The Men of Company K. It is one of the finest small-unit histories of World War II. K Company's first offensive was Operation Clipper. The 84th's mission was to seize the high ground east of Geilenkirchen, along the Siegfried, in conjunction with a British offensive to the left, north. For Clipper, the 84th was under the operation command of the British 30 Corps, commanded by General Brian Horrocks. To K Company, what that meant, mostly, was a daily rum ration, about half a canteen cup. For the first 3 days of Clipper, K Company was in support. It did the mopping up in Geilenkirchen, taking 100 prisoners with no casualties. It was easy. The company congratulated itself and relaxed. Someone was playing a piano, Private Jim Stirner remembered. He looked into a house and found a half-dozen men and his CO, Captain George Giesel, playing the piano with a British lieutenant. The song was Lily Marlene, and our guys were laughing and singing along with him. What I remember most is a feeling of total exhilaration. Boy, this is really great, the way a war ought to be. On November 21st, it was K Company's turn to lead the attack. The men got their rum ration with their breakfast. Sherman tanks with British crews showed up to support the GIs. From a low hill behind the line of departure, First Sergeant Dempsey Keller watched the men climb out of foxholes and form up. These were the men he had trained and worried over for many months. They were the finest men in the world, the very best. I choked up with pride, but I felt cold chills not knowing what was out there waiting for them. It was the one single moment of the war I can never forget. The company advanced. It took possession of a chateau the Germans had been using as an observation post, but had not tried to defend. It moved forward again, but was soon held up by artillery fire. Sergeant Keith Lance led his mortar squad forward to provide support, but as he approached, "We started taking machine gun and rifle fire from a stone farm building off to our right." Lance spread his men out and returned fire, but he couldn't use the mortars and had only 4 M1s and a couple of pistols. Lance heard a voice asking if he could use a bit of help. It was a goddamn British officer standing up in the middle of a firefight without a helmet. He had climbed out of his tank and walked across the field behind us. I told him, "Lordy Jesus, yes, we need some help." The British officer ran back to his tank and gave the farmhouses 3 quick rounds from his 75, one in each window. 30 to 40 Germans poured out, waving white flags. The rifle platoons, meanwhile, were taking a pounding. Linebaugh and Campbell describe it. The concentration of German firepower was absolutely overwhelming with its violence, surprise, and intensity. Artillery fire, 88s and 75s from hidden tanks, and 120 mortars with apparently limitless supplies of ammunition hit us. Machine gun fire whipping in from pillboxes seemed almost an afterthought. The noise, the shock, the sensation of total helplessness and bewilderment, the loss of control, the sudden loss of every familiar assumption. Nothing in civilian life or training offered an experience remotely comparable. Our new boy illusions of the past 2 days dissolved in a moment. It was K Company's welcome to the Western Front. Every rifle company coming on the line that November had a similar experience and drew the same conclusion. There was no way training could prepare a man for combat. Combat could only be experienced, not played at. Training was critical to getting the men into physical condition, to obey orders, to use their weapons, to work effectively with hand signals and radios, and more. It could not teach men how to lie helpless under a shower of shrapnel in a field crisscrossed by machine gun fire. They just had to do it. And in doing it, they joined a unique group of men who have experienced what the rest of us cannot imagine. At Metz, Patton remained steadfast for advance. The CO of 12 Corps, Major General Manton Eddy, was scheduled to send his divisions into Metz on November 8th. Patton boasted that he would reach the Siegfried Line, 65 kilometers east, in not to exceed D plus 2 days. But the downpours, which prevented any air support, the mud, which was so bad even tracked vehicles found it almost impossible to move, and the swollen rivers, which could not be bridged by the engineers, combined to demand postponement of the offensive. Eddy so informed Patton, who invited him to name his successor. The attack went off on schedule. It had a different objective than the earlier attack on Drouin. No one was ready to attack the fortresses head-on. Instead of attempting to surround and reduce the Metz fortresses, Third Army adopted a new policy. The primary mission of all troops is the destruction or capture of the Metz garrison without the investiture or siege of the Metz forts. The plan was to have the 5th Division attack to the northeast of Metz, while the 90th Division would break through the German lines to the south of the city. The two divisions would link up east of Metz, isolating it. Meanwhile, the 95th Division would push into the city itself, supported by the 10th Armored Division. Torrential rains and stiff German resistance held up the 5th and 90th Divisions for a week, but some progress was made, and by November 15th, the encirclement was almost complete. Farther south, meanwhile, other elements of Third Army were pushing eastward. Metz, Patton's goal for 2 months, was finally within his grasp. As new infantry divisions arrived, Patton put them into the line and told their commanders to attack east. The 26th Division was one of these. It included G Company, 328th Regiment, and that company included Sergeant Bruce Egger and Lieutenant Lee Otts, who collaborated to write G Company's War, a vivid account of a rifle company in ETO. On November 11th, G Company went into action east of Nancy. "It occurred to me that this was Armistice Day," Egger wrote, "and wouldn't it be nice if history repeated itself?" Eerily, he heard church bells, and it wasn't Sunday. Then he figured out it was the local French churches observing the end of World War I. Over the following 3 days, the company attacked. Nothing fancy, just a skirmish line advancing until it met resistance, then fire and movement. "Most of the time we fired from the hip," Egger said, "as we could not see anything but trees. Sometimes they made good progress, as much as a kilometer. At other times they were stopped by mortar shells and machine gun fire. Conditions were bad. The mud made movement difficult at best. The air could supply little help. If the FOs, forward observers, brought in the supporting artillery close enough to do any good against the Germans, there were sure to be some shorts causing casualties. Mines were a horror. So was the rain." Egger described the way he spent the second night. "We stopped along the road in a grove of pine trees. We were soaking wet. It had rained all day, and we had been making our way through wet brush. Our bedrolls could not be brought up to us, so we spent the night as best we could by digging a hole and covering the bottom with pine boughs. We slept through the storm, which put down about 6 inches of snow during the night. We were wet, muddy, and shivering from the cold. A barrage of 88s greeted us at daylight. Then it was back to forming a skirmish line and moving out. Nothing spectacular happened. G Company gained a little more ground. After 3 days of this, Egger's platoon was down to 6 men. Of the 525 men in the battalion who had gone into the battle 3 days earlier, 150 were left. It was pulled out of the line to rest and receive replacements. After a week, it moved back into the line. "I dreaded going into combat again," Egger confessed. "The past 2 weeks indicated that my chances of getting through the war unharmed were close to zero, though the odds of coming out of it alive were about 4-1. It fell to Colonel Robert Bacon to take Metz. He organized Task Force Bacon, composed of 2 battalions of infantry of the 95th Division, plus 3 companies of tanks, artillery, and engineers. On November 16th, at 0700 hours, he began the drive to the city, advancing in 2 columns with tanks at the head. When one column met resistance, Bacon moved the other to hit the German flank, throwing sharp jabs and short hooks, moving forward. By dusk the next day, the columns came together near Fort Saint-Julien, 4 kilometers from the city center. Saint-Julien was one of the old Vauban forts. It sat on dominating terrain and commanded the 2 main roads leading into Metz from the north. Surrounded by a moat 12 meters deep and 12 meters wide, with high, thick walls and a covered causeway, it had a garrison of 362 Germans. They had no heavy weapons, but with their machine guns and rifles they could prevent American movement on the main roads. Saint-Julien was the one fort that had to be taken. The assault began at dawn, November 18th, in the fog. By noon, Task Force Bacon had fought its way to the moat. For the next hour, the 75-millimeter cannon on the Shermans, plus the 155-millimeter self-propelled cannon, supported by 240-millimeter howitzers from behind, pounded the fort. At 1300, the infantry jumped off and began to dash across the causeway. The Germans stopped them with heavy small-arms fire. 2 Shermans moved forward to spray enemy firing slits with their 50-caliber machine guns, and a second attempt by the infantry was successful. But then the GIs ran into an iron door that blocked access to Saint-Julien's interior. The Shermans crossed the causeway and fired point-blank at it, but the 75-millimeter shells just bounced off. A tank destroyer with a 90-millimeter gun drove up. It fired 6 rounds at a range of less than 50 yards. They had no effect. With the machine gun fire from the Shermans keeping the Germans back from the firing slits, a 155-millimeter howitzer was wheeled into place. The big gun slammed 10 rounds into the door, but still it held. That Vauban was some builder. The Americans decided that if they couldn't blow the door down, they could destroy its stone facing. The 155-millimeter gun slammed 20 rounds into the door's mounts. Finally, the door collapsed inward with a mighty crash. Infantry moved through the opening, bayonets fixed. They were met by Germans with their hands up. The 155-millimeter had taken the place of the battering ram. This was an altogether new use of the self-propelled artillery. It was part of what was becoming the essence of American tactics in ETO. Whenever possible, use high explosives. German veterans, when asked to comment on the Americans as soldiers, invariably begin with a criticism that whenever GIs ran up against opposition, they hunkered down and called in the artillery. In the German army, the infantry solved its own problems. But most GIs would consider their use of high explosives something to praise, not criticize. With the fall of Saint-Julien, the 95th Division began to move to the center of Metz. It bypassed and isolated the other Vauban forts. On November 22nd, Metz was secured, except that 6 forts around the city were still defiant. The Americans made no attempt to overrun them, and soon enough they began to surrender. The last to give up was Fort Drian, which finally capitulated on December 8th. Patton had taken Metz at a cost of 2,189 casualties in the 95th Division, but in the process inflicting twice that price on the German defenders, plus a bag of 6,000 prisoners. In August, Third Army had advanced almost 600 kilometers from Normandy to the Moselle River. From September 1st to mid-December, it advanced 35 kilometers east of the Moselle. The Siegfried Line, which Patton had said he would reach on November 10th, was still a dozen or so kilometers to the east. In crossing the Moselle and taking Metz, Third Army had suffered 47,039 battle casualties. Up north, the Wacken, K Company continued to attack, side by side with the British. General Horrocks surprised the GIs by showing up on the front lines to see conditions. He was a sympathetic yet critical observer. The 84th struck him as an impressive product of American training methods, which turned out division after division, complete, fully equipped. The division was composed of splendid, very brave, tough young men. But he thought it a bit much to ask of a green division that it penetrate the Siegfried Line, then stand up to counterattacks from two first-class divisions, the 15th Panzer and the 10th SS. And he was disturbed by the failure of American division and corps commanders and their staffs to ever visit the front lines. He was greatly concerned to find that the men were not getting hot meals brought up from the rear, in contrast to the forward units in the British line. He gave the GIs, "My most experienced armored regiment, the Sherwood Ranges Yeomanry," told the American battalion and division commanders to get up front and return to his headquarters. The problem Horrocks saw was becoming endemic in the U.S. Army in ETO. Not even battalion commanders were going to the front. From the Swiss border north to Geilenkirchen, the Americans were attacking. Schaeff put the pressure on 12th Army Group. Bradley passed it on to 1st, 3rd, and 9th Armies. Hodges, Patton, and Simpson told their corps commanders to get results. By the time the pressure reached the battalion COs, it was intense. They raised it even higher as they set objectives for the rifle company COs. The trouble with all this pressure was that the senior officers and their staffs didn't know what they were ordering the rifle companies to do. They had seen neither the terrain nor the enemy. They did their work from maps and over radios and telephones. And unlike the company and platoon leaders who had to be replaced every few weeks at best, and every few days at worst, the staff officers took few casualties, so the same men stayed at the same job, doing it badly. In the First World War, a British staff officer from General Haig's headquarters visited the Somme battlefield a week or so after the battle. The orders had been to attack, with objectives drawn up back at headquarters. The attacks had gone forward through barbed wire, mud, mines, mortar, and machine gun fire, fallen back with appalling loss, only to be ordered forward again. This had gone on for weeks, and the officer looked at the sea of mud and was shocked by his own ignorance. He cried out, "My God, did we really send men to fight in this?" In the Second World War, the U.S. Army in ETO was getting disturbingly close to the British model of the earlier war. When the chase across France was on, senior commanders, although seldom their staffs, were often at the front, urging the men forward. But when the line became stationary, headquarters personnel from battalion on up to corps and army found themselves good billets and seldom strayed. Of course, there were notable exceptions, but in general, the American officers handing down the orders to attack and assigning the objective had no idea what it was like at the front. Any answer to why this happened would have to be a guess, and I have no statistics on front-line visits. But from what combat veterans from the fall campaigns have told me, it was only on the rarest of occasions that any officer above the rank of captain or officer from the staff was seen by them. This was inexcusable. It was humiliating that a British general would have to order American staff officers and their COs to go see for themselves. It was costly to a heartbreaking degree. Tens of thousands of young Americans and Germans died in battles that November, battles that did little to hasten the end of the war and should have been avoided. If there was anything positive to these battles, it was that they gave the American commanders, from Eisenhower on down, the feeling that with all this pressure coming down on them, the Germans surely didn't have the resources to build a reserve for an offensive thrust. Just south of Aachen lay the Hürtgen Forest. Roughly 50 square miles, it sat along the German-Belgian border within a triangle outlined by Aachen, Monschau, and Düren. It was densely wooded, with fir trees 20 to 30 meters tall. They blocked the sun, so the forest floor was dark, damp, devoid of underbrush. The firs interlocked their lower limbs at less than 2 meters, so everyone had to stoop all the time. It was like a green cave, always dripping water, low-roofed and forbidding. The terrain is rugged, a series of ridges and deep gorges formed by the numerous streams and rivers. The Ruhr River ran along the eastern edge of the Hürtgen. Beyond it was the Rhine. First Army wanted to close to the Rhine, which General Hodges decided required driving the Germans out of the forest. Neither he nor his staff noted the obvious point that the Germans controlled the dams upstream on the Ruhr. If the Americans ever got down into the river valley, the Germans could release the dammed-up water and flood the valley. The forest could have been bypassed to the south, with the dams as the objective. The forest without the dams was worthless. The dams without the forest were priceless. But the generals got it backward and went for the forest. Thus did the Battle of Hürtgen get started on the basis of a plan that was grossly, even criminally, stupid. It was fought under conditions as bad as American soldiers ever had to face, even including the Wilderness and the Meuse-Argonne. Sergeant George Morgan of the 4th Division described it. "The forest was a hell of a eerie place to fight. You can't get protection. You can't see. You can't get fields of fire. Artillery slashes the trees like a scythe. Everything is tangled. You can scarcely walk. Everybody is cold and wet, and the mixture of cold rain and sleet keeps falling. They jump off again, and soon there is only a handful of the old men left." On September 19th, the 3rd Armored Division and the 9th Infantry Division began the attack. The lieutenants and captains quickly learned that control of formations larger than platoons was nearly impossible. Troops more than a few feet apart couldn't see each other. There were no clearings, only narrow fire breaks and trails. Maps were almost useless. When the Germans, secure in their bunkers, saw the GIs coming forward, they called down pre-sighted artillery fire, using shells with fuses designed to explode on contact with the treetops. When men dove to the ground for cover, as they had been trained to do, and as instinct dictated, they exposed themselves to a rain of hot metal and wood splinters. They learned that to survive a shelling in the Hürtgen, hug a tree. That way they exposed only their steel helmets. Tanks could barely move on the few roads, as they were too muddy, too heavily mined, too narrow. The tanks could not move at all off the roads. Airplanes couldn't fly. The artillery could shoot, but not very effectively, as FOs couldn't see 10 meters to the front. The Americans could not use their assets, air, artillery, mobility. They were committed to a fight of mud and mines, carried out by infantry skirmish lines plunging ever deeper into the forest, with machine guns and light mortars their only support. For the Germans, it was equally horrible. One enemy commander, General Hans Schmidt of the 275th Infantry Division, called the forest a weird and wild place, where "the dark pine trees and the dense treetops give the forest, even in the daytime, a somber appearance which is apt to cast gloom upon sensitive people." General Paul Malman, commanding the 353rd Infantry Division, said his troops, "We're fighting in deplorable conditions, exposed to incessant enemy fire, fighting daily without relief, receiving little support from their own artillery, drenched by frequent rain and without the possibility of changing clothes. He went on. Forsaken as they were, they had no choice but to hold out in hopeless resignation. For the GIs, it was a calamity. In their September action, the 9th and 2nd Armored lost up to 80% of their frontline troops and gained almost nothing. In October, the 9th, reinforced, tried again, but by mid-month it was dead in the water and had suffered terribly. Casualties were around 4,500 for an advance of 3,000 meters. German losses were somewhat less, around 3,300. Staff officers were learning, if slowly. On the last day of October, the staff of the 9th Division issued a 5-page report, Notes on Woods Fighting. Troops already in the line and still alive knew what the lessons were, but the report was valuable to new units and replacements being fed into the forest. It urged training in forest fighting prior to commitment, said to press against a tree when the shelling began, advised that night operations were physically impossible, suggested never traveling in the woods without a compass, and advised never sending reinforcements forward in the midst of a battle or shelling. Call it off. That's what the GIs wanted to tell the generals, but the generals shook their heads and said, attack. On November 2nd, the 28th Infantry Division took it up. Major General Norman Cota, one of the heroes of D-Day, was the CO. The 28th was the Pennsylvania National Guard and was called the Keystone Division. Referring to the red Keystone shoulder patch, the Germans took to calling it the Bloody Bucket Division. It tried to move forward, but it was like walking into hell. From their bunkers, the Germans set forth a hail of machine gun and rifle fire and mortars. The GIs were caught in thick minefields. Everything was mud and fir trees. The attack stalled. The days were so terrible that I would pray for darkness, Private Clarence Blakesley recalled. And the nights were so bad, I would pray for daylight. Lieutenant John Forsell, K Company, 110th Infantry, 28th Division, had a macabre day-night experience. He was outside the village of Schmidt, which was no man's land. Daily we would check the houses, he explained. The Germans patrolled the same town at night. And one morning our patrol came into town and found a GI hung on the crucifixion cross. We cut him down. We stayed in town and hid in a few houses, waiting for the Germans. A German patrol came in. We had a gunfight. They were caught by surprise. A few of the patrol got away, but we took 3 Germans and hung them on 3 crosses. That ended that little fanfare for both sides in Schmidt. For 2 weeks, the 28th kept attacking, as ordered. On November 5th, division sent down orders to move tanks down a road called the Call Trail. But no staff officer had gone forward to assess the situation in person, and, in fact, the trail was all mud, and anyway blocked by felled trees and disabled tanks. The attack led only to loss. There were men who broke under the strain, and there were heroes. On November 5th, the Germans counterattacked. An unknown GI dashed out of his foxhole, took a bazooka from a dead soldier, and engaged 2 German tanks. He fired from a range of 25 meters and put 1 tank out of action. He was never seen again. On November 6th, an entire company passed the breaking point. An all-night shelling had caused numerous casualties. At dawn, a German counterattack began. When the small arms fire erupted from the woods, the men could endure no more. First one, then another, then 2 and 3 together began to run to the rear. Captain Joe Pruden was sympathetic. They had just had too much. Their endurance could stand no more. But he knew he had to stop them, get them to turn and face the enemy. Along with other officers at the CP, he tried. But the men were pushing, shoving, throwing away equipment, trying to outrun the artillery and each other in a frantic effort to escape. They were all scared. He saw badly wounded men lying where they fell, crying out for medics, being ignored. The 28th's lieutenants kept leading. By November 13th, all the officers in the rifle companies had been killed or wounded. Most of them were within a year of their 20th birthday. Overall, in the Hurtgen, the 28th Division suffered 6,184 combat casualties, plus 738 cases of trench foot and 620 battle fatigue cases. Those figures mean that virtually every frontline soldier was a casualty. Colonel Ralph Ingersoll of First Army's staff met with lieutenants who had just come out of the Hurtgen. They did not talk. They just sat across the table or on the edge of your cot and looked at you very straight and unblinking, with absolutely no expression in their faces, which were neither tense nor relaxed, but completely apathetic. They looked unblinking. Bradley and Hodges remained resolute to take the Hurtgen. They put in the 4th Infantry Division. It had led the way onto Utah Beach on June 6th and gone through a score of battles since. Not many D-Day veterans were still with the division. Most were dead or badly wounded. In the Hurtgen, the division poured out its lifeblood once again. Lieutenant George Wilson was in the battle. He described German methods. Whenever they pulled back under pressure, they called down shelling on the positions they had just left as they occupied prepared bunkers a few hundred meters to the rear. Their new line usually gave them command of everything in front, being perhaps on an upward slope or near the lip of a ravine. Their bunkers were made of thick logs with a few feet of dirt on top. They were almost immune to artillery. They might as well have been concrete. There was no chance of our tanks getting anywhere near them for direct fire. Therefore, Wilson realized the infantry had to take them the hard way, going in after them one at a time, through barbed wire. Lieutenant Wilson had become company's CEO through attrition. His orders were to attack. He tried. His men managed to knock out a machine gun. Then he got on the radio to talk to Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Kennan at battalion. Wilson carefully explained his situation. All his officers were gone. He had many wounded who needed evacuation. His ammunition was almost gone. "I said I didn't see how we could continue in this condition against such a formidable enemy defense. It seemed to me I was completely objective, simply listing the plain facts, and that my assessment was correct." Colonel Kennan replied, "Wilson, ammo is on the way over now. I know what you're up against, and I know you can and will continue to advance and take that line of defense." And hung up. The ammo arrived. Wilson attacked. His company managed to advance about 500 meters. The Germans fell back to their next MLR. Wilson commented, "It was extremely costly yardage, possibly the most expensive real estate in the world, and we never could have gone the other 1,500 yards to the original objective set by Kennan." Between November 7th and December 3rd, the 4th Division lost over 7,000 men, or about 10 per company per day. "Replacements flowed in to compensate for the losses," Michael Debler comments, "but the Hurtgen's voracious appetite for casualties was greater than the Army's ability to provide new troops." Lieutenant Wilson recorded his company losses at 167% for enlisted men. "We had started with a full company of about 162 men and had lost about 287. Sergeant Mac Morris was there with the 4th. "Hurtgen had its fire breaks, only wide enough to allow two jeeps to pass, and they were mined and interdicted by machine gun fire. There was a teller mine every 8 paces for about 3 miles. Hurtgen's roads were blocked. The Germans cut roadblocks from trees. They cut them down so they interlocked as they fell. Then they mined and booby-trapped them. Finally, they registered their artillery on them and the mortars, and at the sound of men clearing them, they opened fire. Their strong points were constructed carefully, and inside them were neat bunks built of forest wood, and the walls of the bunkers were paneled with wood. These sheltered the defenders. Outside the bunkers were their defensive positions. First Army put the 8th Infantry Division into the attack. On November 27th, it closed to the town of Hurtgen, the original objective of the offensive when it began in mid-September. It fell to Lieutenant Paul Bosch, Company G, 121st Infantry, to take the town. At dawn on November 28th, Bosch put one of his lieutenants to the left side of the road leading to town, while he took the other platoon to the other side. Bosch ran from man to man, explaining what the company was about to do. When he gave the signal, they charged. "It was sheer pandemonium," he recalled. "Once out of that damned forest, the men went mad with battle lust." Bosch described it as a wild, terrible, awe-inspiring thing. "We dashed, struggled from one building to another, shooting, bayoneting, clubbing. Hand grenades roared, fires cracked, buildings to the left and right burned with acrid smoke. Dust, smoke, and powder filled our lungs, making us cough, spit. Automatic weapons chattered, while heavier throats of mortars and artillery disgorged deafening explosions. The wounded and dead, men in the uniforms of both sides, lay in grotesque positions at every turn." American tanks supported Bosch's company. He remembered that they would first spray the buildings with their 50 calibers, then use their 75s to blow holes for use by the infantry. "We hurled ourselves through the holes or through windows or splintered doors. Then it became a battle from floor to floor, from room to room." The company took nearly 300 prisoners. As the battle sputtered to a close, Bosch started to shake, and it wasn't the cold. I realized that I had not been afraid during that whole day. Not once did I feel afraid. I was busy as hell, and that occupied my mind. But when I shook visibly on that floor with a roof at least 2 feet thick over my head, I was hoping that I would not forget to be afraid, because that was the best way to stay alive, to not make careless moves. He was wounded later that night by a German shell and was sent to a hospital in the States. The 8th Division didn't get far beyond Hurtgen. By December 3rd, it was used up. A staff officer from regiment was shocked when he visited the front that day. He reported, "The men of this battalion are physically exhausted. The spirit and will to fight are there. The ability to continue is gone. These men have been fighting without rest or sleep for 4 days, and last night had to lie unprotected from the weather in an open field. They are shivering with cold, and their hands are so numb that they have to help one another on with their equipment. I firmly believe that every man up there should be evacuated through medical channels." Many had trench foot. All had bad colds, or worse, plus diarrhea. In late November, the 2nd Ranger Battalion entered the forest. Following its heavy losses at Point du Hoc and Omaha Beach on D-Day, and an equally costly campaign in Normandy, the battalion had gone to Brest, then back to northern France. It had been attached to various divisions and corps as needed. Although the battalion had taken more than 100% casualties, the core of the force that Lieutenant Colonel James Earl Rudder had led ashore on June 6th was still there. Captain Sidney Solomon, who had led a platoon onto Omaha Beach, was now CO of B Company. Lieutenant Len Lomel, who had destroyed the big guns at Point du Hoc at 0830 on D-Day, had been given a battlefield commission, the first Ranger to be so honored. Lieutenant James Eichner, who used a World War I signal lamp on D-Day to direct naval fire, was in charge of Rudder's communications. Sergeant Leo Lisko, who had operated the lamp and is today the Ranger historian, was there. Altogether, the battalion had 485 enlisted men and 27 officers, less than half the size of a full-strength infantry battalion. The battalion was assigned to the 28th Division in the Hurtgen. Rudder, Eichner, and the others were disappointed. Eichner explained, "We were a very specialized unit, all volunteers, highly trained in special missions. Putting us out on a front line in a defensive position wasn't utilizing our skills and capabilities. The attrition, not only from the shelling, but also from the weather, the trench foot, just sitting there in those foxholes making a furor every now and then, and a little scrap now and then. And we were very disappointed about this." As the battalion moved into the line, it took casualties from mines and artillery. Then the men sat in foxholes and took a pounding. This wasn't the Rangers' idea of war at all. On December 6th, opportunity arrived. Hill 400, named after its height in meters, was on the eastern edge of the forest, and therefore was the ultimate objective of the campaign. It was the highest point in the area and provided excellent observation of the Roar River less than a kilometer to the east, and of the mixed farmland and forest around it. The Germans had utilized it so effectively that neither GIs nor vehicles moved during the day. As the Rangers replaced a battalion of the 28th around midnight, they were warned that the slightest movement in the daytime would bring down 88s and mortars. The village of Berkstein huddled at the base of the hill. First Army had thrown four divisions at Hill 400, concentrated artillery fire, and when the weather was suitable, fighter-bomber attacks preceded each attempt to drive the Germans off the hill. In every instance, the Germans had come up out of their bunkers, manned their weapons, and stopped the slowly advancing line of American skirmishers. Then artillery and mortar fire began exploding among the prostrate GIs, who fell back. Hundreds had been sacrificed, with no gain. Something new had to be tried. On December 6th, the desperate 8th Division commander asked for the Rangers. At the same moment, Ranger leadership was changing. Rudder had been put in command of the 109th Infantry Regiment. His executive officer, Captain George Williams, was at division headquarters, where the CO had just told him to attack the hill at 0300, December 7th. Williams convinced the CO to wait until dawn. The CO wanted to lay in an artillery barrage. Williams indicated that the Rangers would rather have surprise than explosives. He explained that the Rangers had trained to do things a bit differently. As Lieutenant Lommel put it, "Our Ranger tactics seem to be needed, stealthful and speedy infiltration and surprise assaults where they were not expected at first light. The bigger outfits were too visible. We could sneak into the line." When he returned to Ranger HQ, Williams learned that Rudder was leaving. Rudder promoted him to major, talked to him about the upcoming attack, and went on to his new duties. Shortly after midnight, the Rangers marched to Berkstein. They were shelled by harassing fire on the road. Eichner commented that, "It reminded me of one of the old World War I movies that showed units under shell fire at night." As they approached Berkstein, Sergeant Earl Lutz came out from the village to guide them in. "I was told to go to a certain road," Lutz recalled. "I got to the road, but there was nothing to be seen. No sound, not even a cricket. I guess I swore a little, and the Rangers raised up all around me." In town, the Rangers replaced the 47th Armored Infantry Battalion, 8th Division. There was no ceremony. Three Ranger lieutenants showed up at the 47th CP. They asked for enemy positions and the road to take, said they were ready to go. We talked the situation over. They stopped and said, "Let's go, men." We heard the Tommy guns click, and without a word, the Rangers moved out. our morale went up in a hurry. By 0300, three companies of Rangers, A, B, and C, had dug in on the edge of a wood near the base of the hill. Companies D, E, and F took possession of Bergstein and dug in around it. The companies near the hill prepared to charge it at first light. They could hit the hill through open fields of some 100 meters wide, exposing themselves to enemy small arms and mortar fire, or try a flanking move through known minefields. Major Williams chose the open field. The men fixed bayonets. Sergeant Bill Petty, who had distinguished himself on D-Day, recalled that tension was building up to the exploding point. At first light, shouting, "Let's go get the bastards!" and firing from the hip, the Rangers charged. They got through the snow-covered field despite the small arms and mortar fire and started up the hill. Four machine guns were firing point-blank on the Rangers, who kept moving up the hill, yelling and firing. Sergeant Bud Potratz remembered hollering, "Hi-o, Silver!" Those who were at Pontduoc on D-Day recall Hill 400 as worse. It was not as precipitous, but it was rocky shale with frost and snow on it, and they had no grappling hooks or ropes. It was hand over hand, using the third hand to keep up a stream of fire. The Germans were caught by surprise. They had good troops on the hill, but not good enough. Ranger small arms fire kept them pinned down, while other Rangers tossed grenades into the bunkers. Months later, Sergeant Forrest Pogue of the historical section interviewed Williams. It was March 21, 1945, in Germany on the far side of the Rhine. Pogue noted that Williams's statements were hurried because he was preparing for a night problem. Those Rangers never stopped training. Williams told Pogue how it was done. "We took the hill by rushing it. One squad of D Company went over the top of the hill down towards the front. This group didn't have many casualties, although the next group was hard hit." When Sergeant Petty reached the top of the hill, he found a situation of turmoil. With another Ranger named Anderson, he approached the main bunker and heard Germans inside. They pushed open the door and tossed in two grenades. Just as they were ready to rush in and spray the room with their BAR, a shell exploded a few feet away. The Germans were firing on their own position. The explosion blew Anderson into Petty's arms. He was dead, killed instantly by a big piece of shrapnel in his heart. One squad chased the remaining Germans down the hill, almost to the Roar River, then pulled back to the top where the Rangers were trying to dig in. It was all but impossible on the slippery shale. It was 0830. The shelling intensified. Rangers took shelter in the bunkers and waited for the inevitable counterattack. Petty recovered Anderson's dying brother and had the dubious distinction of having hold of both brothers while they were in the process of dying within an hour's time. At 0930, the first of five counterattacks that day began. They came mostly from the south and east, where woods extended to the base of the hill and gave the Germans cover almost all the way, in company-size strength. Major Williams told Pogue, "In some cases, Germans were in and around the bunker on the hill before the Rangers were aware of their presence. Once on the hill, they attempted to rush the positions. They used machine guns, burp guns, rifles, and threw potato masher grenades. Hand-to-hand fights developed on top of the hill, in which some use was made of bayonets." The Germans simultaneously attacked the town, where Williams had his HQ. They had direct fire of 88s, self-propelled guns, mortars, and artillery, and they attacked from all sides. Five of them got within 100 yards of the church, which was being used as a first aid station. Williams added that he learned that day, "If you want to hold a town, you must stay outside it. Companies A, B, and C stayed outside Bergstein and got very few casualties." German doctrine was the opposite. Hold the center, was their idea. Through the day and into the night, the Germans attacked Hill 400. Field Marshal Model offered iron crosses and 2 weeks' leave to any of his men who could retake the hill. At times, Lieutenant Lommel remembered, "We were outnumbered 10-1. We had no protection. Continuous tons of shrapnel falling upon us, hundreds of rounds coming in." At one point, Lommel saw his platoon sergeant, Ed Secor. A very quiet man, out of ammo and unarmed, seize 2 machine pistols from wounded Germans and, in desperation, charge a large German patrol, firing and screaming at them. His few remaining men rallied to the cause, and together they drove the Germans back down the hill. Lommel is a legend among the Rangers for what he did on D-Day. In 1995, he commented, "June 6, 1944 was not my longest day. December 7, 1944 was my longest and most miserable day on Earth during my past 75 years." As Ranger numbers dwindled and ammunition began to run out, the American artillery saved the men. The field of vision was such that the forward observer, Lieutenant Howard Kettlehut from the 56th Armored Field Artillery Battalion, could call in fire all around the hill. The Rangers later said Kettlehut was the best man we ever worked with. Or, as Williams put it to Pogue, "At one point, Kettlehut brought down fire from all artillery available in Corps, 18 battalions in all. 155s, 75s, self-propelled 8-inch and 240-millimeter guns placed a ring of explosive shells around the hill." During the night, ammo bearers got to the top of the hill and brought down wounded on litters, terribly difficult on the snow, ice, and rocks. The combined strength of the 3 companies left on top was 5 officers and 86 men. Lommel was wounded. Just after daylight, the Germans shelled the town and the hill. On the hill, it was of such intensity that one explosion would cover the sound of the next approaching shell. But when the Germans attacked with infantry, a combination of the shells called in by Kettlehut and the small arms fire of the Rangers drove them back. Late on December 8th, an infantry regiment and tank destroyer battalion relieved the surviving Rangers. A week and 2 days later, the Germans retook the hill. Not until February 1945 did the Americans get it back. The Rangers had suffered 90% casualties and would once again have to be rebuilt. With the Battle of Hill 400, the Hurtgen campaign came to a close. The Americans did not have the dams upstream, so they dared not debouch down into the valley. The forest they held, for which they had paid such a high price, was worthless. The Battle of Hurtgen lasted 90 days. 9 divisions plus supporting units on the American side were involved, more men than Meade had at Gettysburg. The losses were comparable to Gettysburg, too, or the Wilderness. There were more than 24,000 combat casualties, another 9,000 victims of trench foot, disease, or combat exhaustion. In February 1945, the 82nd Airborne followed a retreating German army through the forest. The 505th PIR got into the town of Schmidt, which had changed hands many times during the battle. The history of the 505th noted that throughout Sicily, Italy, Normandy, and Holland, this unit has seen the devastation of war, but never anything to compare with this. There were tanks, tank destroyers, jeeps, 2.5-ton trucks, other vehicles, and all sorts of GI equipment, as well as countless American dead. It was no wonder the men referred to this as Death Valley. General Rolf von Gersdorff commented after the war, "I have engaged in the long campaigns in Russia, as well as other fronts, and I believe the fighting in the Hurtgen was the heaviest I have ever witnessed." Still, the Germans were delighted that the Americans wanted to throw their weight into an attack against dug-in troops in a forest. What had gone wrong? Not only at Hurtgen, but up north, too, where the Ninth Army pounded against the Siegfried Line. Captain John O'Grady of Ninth Army's historical section provided some of the answer. He was at headquarters, 3rd Battalion, 333rd Infantry, in late November. He sent a memorandum back to 9th Army. On 23rd November, the battalion was attacking a superior German force entrenched on an excellent position. The only thing that higher headquarters contributed to the debacle was pressure, and God only knows where the pressure started, perhaps Corps or perhaps Army. It had the effect of ordering men to die needlessly. O'Grady was furious. Tactics and maneuver on battalion or regiment scale were conspicuous by their absence. It never seemed to occur to anyone that the plan might be wrong, but rather the indictment was placed on the small unit commanders and the men who were doing the fighting. The companies went into battle against the formidable Siegfried Line, with hand grenades and rifle bullets against pillboxes. The 84th Division walked into the most touted defensive line in modern warfare without so much as the benefit of a briefing by combat officers. The Americans took the forest, but lost the Battle of Hurtgen, and too many good men. The battle did not shorten the war by 1 minute. For those reasons, it is remembered today by those who were there. The Americans had taken Aachen and Metz and the Hurtgen, but at such a cost, in time and lives, that for those who were not there, these great battles are hard to recall. As Lieutenant Lommel put it, "The months-long battle of the Hurtgen Forest was a loser that our top brass ever after never seemed to want to talk about." On December 8th, from the OP, observation post on Hill 400, Lieutenant Eichner remembered, "We could see across the Rohr River to a town called Nidingen. Trains were puffing in there and bringing in troops at all." They were heading south. Eichner had cause to feel discouraged. If, after all that pounding, the Germans were building a reserve somewhere to the south, why then it was the Germans, not the Americans, who had won the battles of attrition in the fall of 1944. The Americans had no reserve at all, save the 82nd and 101st Airborne, which were near Reims, being brought up to strength after the Holland campaign. Every other division in ETO was committed to offensive action. Chapter 7. The Ardennes, December 16th through 19th, 1944. When the Americans reached the German border, their best intelligence sources dried up. Inside Germany, the Wehrmacht used secure telephone lines rather than radio, which rendered ultra deaf and blind. Local inquiry in France had given superb intelligence. At the German border, civilians shrugged and shook their heads when asked questions. Early December weather kept the reconnaissance aircraft on the ground, and in the Ardennes, patrols were rare and seldom aggressive, as each side was willing to leave the other alone so long as things stayed quiet. As a result, the GIs in the Ardennes, like the American intelligence apparatus as a whole, were no better off in the intelligence field than Billy Yank had been 80 years earlier. But owing to complacency and smugness, almost no one worried about it. As 21st Army Group's intelligence summary on December 16, 1944, put it, "The enemy is at present fighting a defensive campaign on all fronts. His situation is such that he cannot stage major offensive operations." Certainly not in the Ardennes, where the line had been stagnant and the guns mostly quiet for 2 months. In late October 1944, Lieutenant Robert Merriman of the Army's historical section had been in a jeep headed south along Skyline Drive, a ridgeline on the eastern edge of the Ardennes, just west of the Ore River, which was the German-Belgian border. All was peaceful, he recalled. Farmers in the fields along the road were plowing their fields for the winter fallow, and some were taking in the last of the summer harvest. Cattle were grazing lazily. A few Americans learned that the pastoral scene was deceiving. P-47 pilot Captain Jack Barensfeld had flown more than 80 missions between D-Day and mid-December. On the 14th, he flew over the wooded area of the Eifel on the German side of the Ohr River. The briefing officer had assured the pilots that the place was benign, but a great amount of anti-aircraft fire came up. One of our pilots was hit and killed. Barensfeld reported the incident, but no one thought anything of the surprising amount of AA the Germans had in this quiet area. Captain Franklin Anderson of the 4th Division was in a wood near Saint-Vit, Belgium, on December 14th. He went into town to purchase some orange soda at the local bottling plant. There was a crowd of agitated people in the town square. Anderson asked the owner of the plant, who spoke excellent English, "What's going on?" The man replied, "They think the Germans are going to be back here soon." Anderson asked why. "The Boche always come through the Ardennes. Now there is activity, noise, and so forth over to the east, and they are worried." Anderson reported the conversation to his CO, adding other details. Elise Diehl, a Belgian woman who had visited relatives on the German side of the border, reported intense activity. She saw rubber boats, bridging equipment, and more. A patrol brought in a Polish soldier who had been conscripted into the German army, who warned of an impending attack. Anderson's CO sent the information on to battalion, who passed it along to division intelligence. There it died. Human intelligence made little impression on these 20th century warriors, who had signal intelligence to keep them apprised of the enemy's order of battle. Intelligence makes no decisions. The mindset of the people receiving the information is more important than the intelligence itself. In early December, Eisenhower reviewed the situation on the Western Front with Bradley. His overwhelming goal was to strengthen U.S. 1st and 9th Armies to continue the winter offensive north of Aachen. He was preparing to strip divisions from Patton's 3rd Army to send north. Turning to the center of his line, he and Bradley discussed the weakness in the Ardennes. 4 divisions, 2 green, 2 so worn down by Hurtgen fighting that they had been withdrawn and sent to this rest area to refit and take in replacements, spread over a 150-kilometer front, seemed to invite a counterattack. Bradley said it would be unprofitable to the Germans to make such an attack. Of course, the generals were aware of how the Germans had sliced right through the area in May 1940, but that was against almost no opposition in good weather. Further, they determined that the newly formed Volksgrenadier divisions were hardly capable of offensive action in winter conditions, and that the Germans could not supply a major thrust through the Ardennes on winter roads. Finally, they agreed that the Germans could take no significant strategic spot within the Ardennes, and that the weight of the counterattack the Americans could bring to bear on any German salient would be decisive. So they told each other that an Ardennes attack would be a strategic mistake for the enemy.
This ends Disc 6.